Michael Palin explores a monument with towering archways.
On a windswept hill in northern France stands one of the great memorials to the dead from the First World War. It was a war which affected almost every family in Britain, including my own.
Crowds hold banners proclaiming Germany surrenders.
But even after the armistice was signed on November the 11th, 1918, the terrible reality was that soldiers continued to be killed in battle.
Black and white photographs of World War I soldiers.
90 years on, I'm going on a journey to tell the story of the last day of World War I. Of the general who sacrificed lives storming a town simply so his troops could have a bath.
Well, that lunatic decision cost something like 300 casualties, many of them battle deaths, for an inconceivable reason.
Of the sometimes forgotten victims.
And you can see that the whole of the side of the face has been literally just taken off.
Just ripped out.
Yes.
And yet he was still alive.
He was still alive.
Of the men who would die in the instants before peace.
He was hit by a single rifle bullet, fell and died 2 minutes before the armistice.
There's his grave, your grandfather's grave.
And how, 90 years later, that sense of loss still prevails.
It's very emotional.
Yeah.
Probably the first relatives to visit.
This is the story of how the war, which was meant to end all wars, finally came to a close.
Archive footage of soldiers using ropes to lower a body into the ground. The last day of World War I. A human skull morphs into a series of faces, ranging from an old man to a newborn baby. BBC. Time Watch. Presented by Michael Palin.
Just after 5 o'clock on the morning of the 11th of November, 1918, a moment of global significance was about to occur. In this forest north of Paris, the two sides in the bloodiest conflict the world had ever known faced each other for a final showdown. Hidden in the trees here at Compiègne was a railway siding. On it, the personal train belonging to Allied Supreme Commander Marshal Ferdinand Foch. 3 days earlier, a German peace delegation had arrived here, and during the small hours of Monday the 11th, inside Foch's carriage, they agreed the terms for a ceasefire, an armistice.
At a long table in an ornate railway carriage,
it was at this table in Marshal Foch's private train that the two opponents met. The Germans on the left here, the British and French facing them on the right. A member of the British delegation noted the Germans as being very quiet, very servile, and by the end, cringing. At 5:10 that morning, the two sides signed, bringing to an end the First World War.
Headline, Surrender of Germany.
Within 30 minutes of the signing, the news was flashed around the world that the war to end all wars was now finally over.
Well, almost. Although the armistice had been signed, the war was not yet over. It still had 6 hours left to run.
Newsreel of jubilant crowds.
Despite the celebrations on streets across the globe, the ceasefire would not come into effect until 11 a.m., so that troops on the front line would be sure of getting the news that the fighting had stopped. At least, that was the plan.
What actually happened that morning was not the expected peace, but more of the bloodshed and slaughter that had happened on an almost daily basis for the previous 4 years of the First World War.
Soldiers in narrow trenches, tank guns blast, explosions on a battlefield.
For 4 long years, the war had raged as the armies of Britain, France, Russia and their allies fought Germany and hers. The slaughter was on an industrial scale. The conflict had become gridlocked in trench warfare along a static line known as the Western Front.
a deserted, muddy battlefield. Only shattered tree trunks are standing as the branches litter the ground.
From the border of neutral Switzerland in the south, the Western Front snaked its way 450 miles northwards to the Belgian coast.
Michael climbs a hill through woodland.
For Britain, World War I had started over Belgian neutrality, so it seemed fitting that this was where it would end. On the 10th of November, British and Canadian troops, led by General Sir Arthur Currie, reached the outskirts of the Belgian town of Mons, a town that had been occupied by the Germans for the past 4 years. And with the armistice approaching, it was from Mons, where the British had been forced to retreat in the opening weeks of the war in August 1914, that some of the final casualties would occur.
As flames rage around them, soldiers fight their way through the burning remains of a building. Michael passes through tall iron gates.
The village cemetery at Nouvelle, on the outskirts of Mons, is like any other in this part of Belgium, and yet within it there are 9 white headstones which tell a remarkable story.
These are British war graves, and these 4, by chance, an Englishman, an Irishman, a Welshman and a Scotsman, different nations perhaps, but they share one thing in common. All of them died on the last day of the war, 11th of November, 1918.
Private J. Stoneham.
And just here, the most extraordinary thing about a place like this is there are 5 more British graves. And all these died at the very beginning of the war, in August 1914. So there you have, separated by about 5 or 6 feet, a war of 4 years, and nearly 1 million British lives lost.
2 lines of parallel white gravestones.
Amongst the graves of the 4 soldiers killed on the 11th of November 1918 is Harold Walpole from Giddington in Northamptonshire. In the 7 months Harold had been in France, he was wounded 3 times. The 3rd time, in the retaking of Mons, was to prove fatal. Harold Walpole was just 19 years old. But how many other soldiers, like Harold Walpole, actually died on the last day of the First World War?
The harsh reality is that headstones engraved with the date November 11th, 1918, are far from rare occurrences. They're to be found on graves all around Mons and much further afield as well.
The soldiers' graves all show they died on the 11th of November 1918. Engravers are working on the headstones, using their tools to etch words and symbols.
The graves and memorials of the British and Commonwealth soldiers who died in the First World War are maintained by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. The records of those who died are held at the Commission's headquarters in Maidenhead, and among them are those who died on the 11th of November, 1918.
Peter Francis, Commonwealth War Graves Commission.
We're talking about First World War here alone, 1.1 million Commonwealth servicemen and women dying. And there's a huge amount of corresponding paperwork that's necessary to commemorate them.
Even amongst the chaos and carnage of war, the details of deaths were painstakingly recorded.
By looking just at the 11th of the 11th, 1918, we get a figure of 863 Commonwealth servicemen and women dying on the very last day of the war.
Countless white headstones stretch into the distance.
It's a sobering thought that 863 British and Commonwealth servicemen died on the last day of World War I. But of course, many of them were dying of wounds sustained days, weeks, even months earlier.
In a newspaper, various soldiers are pictured.
One of those 863 soldiers who died on the 11th of November 1918 was Private Lewis Williams, from Charlton Kings in Gloucestershire. He was the last of three brothers to die in the war.
Soldiers lie in a trench as explosions rain debris around them.
1918 had been a costly year for Britain and her allies. It had started badly in late March, when the Germans launched one last offensive with which they hoped to finally break the deadlock of the Western Front.
Dr. Robert Foley.
The offensives during the spring of 1918 were really designed to end the war before the Americans could arrive in sufficient strength to tip the balance in the favor of the Allies. They often termed it the last card or the last gamble. There was a real recognition that their manpower would probably run out sometime in 1918, and that they had to use this last opportunity to try to force the French and the British to capitulate.
On the first day of the offensive, the 21st of March, German forces ripped a hole 60 miles wide, advancing 40 miles deep into the British lines. It was the biggest territorial gain either side had made since the opening weeks of World War I. And then, at the point of defeat, the Allied commanders rallied their troops.
Douglas Haig, a general who is renowned in history as being inarticulate, as not having a great connection with his troops, issues his so-called backs to the wall order that says, you know, we're facing a crisis situation, the Germans are about to break through, we're facing defeat. Everybody's got to fight. Our backs are to the wall.
The gamble had almost succeeded. But weakened by their own losses, the Germans were first held and then pushed back in July on the River Marne.
And then the second moment, the 8th of August 1918, the British launched an attack at Amiens, the so-called Black Day of the German army.
On a map, the German line retreats.
From this point onwards, the Germans went from attack to defence as the Allies forced them back over the ground they'd recently gained. They would never recover.
By the summer of 1918, the German army is really starting to fall apart. They've suffered extremely high casualties in their offensives throughout the spring and early summer. They are literally starving as well. The Allied blockade is really sort of biting into the German army and into the German society.
The Allied naval blockade was not only biting into the German army, it was affecting the German people too. This photograph of a dead horse being butchered in a German street shows the length the half-starved civilian population was driven to.
Black and white film of a vast steamership teeming with thousands of soldiers.
But what Germany had most feared was already happening. The arrival of American soldiers who called themselves the Doughboys.
The Americans come in a flood tide. Almost every other day, a troop ship is landing in France and it's disgorging 10,000, 15,000 doughboys. They're arriving at a rate of 300,000 a month. And this is just overpowering. The sheer numbers of the Americans make clear the hopelessness of the situation for the Germans, and it tips the decision of the war in the Allies' favor.
Joseph E. Persico, author.
The British and French had wanted the fresh American troops absorbed into their armies to replace their ever-mounting losses. But General John Pershing, the leader of American forces, refused, insisting that American troops would fight as an independent army under his command. The Allied armies coordinated their counterattacks along the front line, with Pershing and his American forces converging on an area west of the River Meuse. It was here in the Argonne Forest in the east of France that the real fighting for the Americans began. In the first 4 hours in action here in autumn 1918, the Americans sustained more casualties than on the whole of D-Day in World War II. It seemed that Pershing and his generals had failed to heed the lessons learnt by their allies in the preceding years of the war.
The Americans fought the same early battles all over again. Above ground advances, and they took punishing losses in the months in which they were engaged towards the end of the war.
So
In the Argonne Forest, there is still evidence of the bloody battles in the autumn of 1918. Local historian Jean-Paul de Vries has been walking this ground for the past three decades.
On this position, just with a few machine guns, you can hold everything.
Yeah.
Because it's high, you are well entrenched.
Yeah. And was this trench taken eventually by the Americans?
It's been taken, yeah. It took them 3 days and a lot of casualties. Hundreds of men fell by taking this ridge.
Yeah.
But they took it after 3 days. It's the 32nd Division who took it.
This photograph shows the Kriemhilde Trench, not long after the Americans captured it that autumn. It had been taken, but with heavy casualties.
Partly covered bodies of dead soldiers lie side by side in a trench. Michael and Jean-Paul look down from a steep slope.
That is a very, very steep hill that the Americans had to come up to take this position.
And they were thousands, and Germans were just hundreds. Mm. And they stopped them for 3 days.
Mm. And this wasn't the only hill.
No, no. They already had about 20 hills before they came. Yeah. They still have 20 to go.
Archive film of soldiers charging across the battlefield. A wide expanse of muddy ground.
And each year you can come back because each year you got new...
This field close by was once part of the American battleground. Since the end of the First World War, it has remained completely undisturbed. Now it's giving up its iron harvest. The earth here groans with unused munitions. Every turn of the plough reveals yet more evidence of bitter fighting.
There you got some detonators. I don't pick them up because they're too dangerous. You have one there, and you got the other one.
So if you... those could...
They could explode.
So actually just ploughing this field, as they have done now, that must be pretty dangerous.
Look there.
Clips.
All American clips. Wow.
Cluster of clips, God, look at that.
Look there, there.
Yeah.
Unfired rounds from American rifles litter the field 90 years on.
Here, you got a big piece of shell. Shrapnel, you call it, I think, huh?
Yes.
You still see the screwing lines for the head.
Yeah. Can I have a look at that one? Here's so much about shrapnel. Now, that is heavy. And
this is heavy, and this is coming a few hundred kilometres at you.
Yeah, imagine a bit of shard of that going into you.
Jean-Paul is showing Michael his collection.
So as you can see here, you got the American corner that is everything.
In 30 years, Jean-Paul has found over 40,000 artifacts from the First World War, all within 5 miles of his home, and now on display in his museum in the village of Romagna.
You got all this stuff being found.
So, and this looks... Wow, can I just feel this?
Take it up, it's heavy. Ah, you can feel the weight of it.
German, stone. French,
no, it's American US-17. They call it the P-17. It's an Enfield rifle, the sister of the English Enfield.
It's almost sort of become part of the countryside. It looks like a great bit of wood, actually.
It's
but there 19, you are. You've got the bolt.
It's been 19
and
years
there.
In the water, and it's
And people's boots. Look at these. Yeah.
They come out of the fields, and to find a pair of boots in the field, I think it's not a good sign.
That's an American army boot again, is it?
Very bad shape, but this is a nice one because. I don't like wars. This canteen is marking G.W. Flint. No good for shit.
No good for shit. This was a...
It was the lid of the mess tin. This is the mess tin.
Now
you got normally your fork, knife, a spoon in there. Yeah. This one has been hit. And you can see the shell. True.
I mean, that is the extraordinary thing that just ordinary, almost domestic objects, that just for keeping you alive, for eating your food, it's got that sort of scar of the war.
If you're missing this, there's something wrong. You're wounded, or you're dead, or I don't know what.
Yes.
This is what I like very much, is Colgate shaving sticks. Colgate and Company.
New York, USA.
It's still used each day.
And they look, you know, like something rather nicely kitschy, you get out of a store. But these are in someone's kit. Yeah.
This one is too complete to be thrown away.
They would have shaved, and I mean, they might have been killed. Couple of hours later.
Michael is holding two tiny metal cylinders, one of them shattered. On a map, the German line encroaching into France is being pushed back.
As the autumn of 1918 wore on, the Allied armies continued to force the Germans to withdraw.
So we shouldn't really think of this last period of the First World War as being like the trench warfare that we normally think of and normally associate with the middle years of the First World War. This is what's called semi-open warfare. So although parts of the German army are still resisting quite hard, particularly specialists, machine gunners, artillery units, a lot of the German army is in full-scale retreat. The British are trying to keep contact with it because they don't want a chance for another defensive line to be formed.
But that's precisely what happened just 7 days before the war ended. The Germans formed up along a 20-mile stretch of the Sambre-Oise Canal, a natural defensive barrier to the Allies' advance.
Beside a waterway lined with trees.
Nothing much has changed beside this French canal in 100 years. It looks almost exactly as it would have done on the morning of November the 4th, 1918, when along this stretch began the last set battle of World War I.
A contemporary aerial photo from the time shows the objective for one group of soldiers that day. An isolated lock house, called simply Lock Number One. It's a building which still stands to this day. Military historian Paul Reed has interviewed over 300 British veterans from World War I, some of whom fought here that November morning.
So what happened exactly here?
Well, this particular point, Lock Number One, got the lock house here and the lock in front of us. The 2nd Royal Sussex, supported by engineers and Australian engineers, crossed the flat ground.
Why did they attack here, where there was a German position?
The tempting thing here was the lock, because it's much narrower, and it's a very strong lock, so you could actually support a proper bridge here at a later date to get wheeled transport across, artillery across, and so on.
They were really virtually defenceless there. There was absolutely no cover at all.
One of the machine gunners from the Sussex rushes up to the far lock gates we can see there. He opened fire with his Lewis machine gun straight up into the building, and that burst of fire silenced temporarily the German machine gunners, enabling them to drop the bridges on this narrow gap here. And at the point of the bayonet, they rushed the remaining Germans here. And
hand-to-hand fighting.
Hand-to-hand fighting, and the German defence buckled under that sort of pressure, really.
So what were the losses here, then, during the battle?
There was just over 30 men killed here, about 120 wounded, and the killed included three Australians who became the last Australians to be killed in action on the Western Front.
The Australian sappers, Barrett, Johnson and Corporal Davy, now lie in a small cemetery less than a mile from where they fell.
Sunlight falls on rows of white headstones.
By 8 a.m. on the 4th of November, the canal had been crossed, and along the entire front, the Germans pushed back a further 2 miles. But for the British, this last set battle of the war had come at a heavy cost.
More men went over the top here than on the first day of the Battle of the Somme in 1916, when so many were killed. The casualties here were much smaller, but even then, nearly 2,000 British soldiers gave their lives on the front line that day, including a 25-year-old lieutenant from the Manchester Regiment, the war poet, Wilfred Owen.
A gravestone is marked with Lieutenant W.E.S. Owen.
In the years following his death, Wilfred Owen's poetry would symbolise what many considered to be the cruelty and the waste that was the First World War.
A formal picture of Wilfred Owen in uniform, then another photograph showing a vast multitude of soldiers grouped together.
With hundreds of thousands of prisoners of war taken by the Allies, the German army was now on the brink of total collapse.
A headline reads, "Spread of the German Red Flag Revolt."
Back in Germany itself, revolution was afoot. Soldiers and sailors mutinied and deserted, leaving the remnants of the army with the unenviable task of fighting the Allies on one front and their own people on the other.
Soldiers point guns through makeshift barricades.
Faced with disaster, the German government dispatched civilian representatives to negotiate a ceasefire with the Allied commanders in France.
An artist's impression of cars carrying white flags coming towards a group of soldiers.
On Thursday, November the 7th, French soldiers on the front line near La Capelle witnessed the extraordinary sight of several large German cars bearing white flags emerging from the mist. Inside the cars was a peace delegation, and leading the party was the German politician Matthias Erzberger.
They're driven through this devastated countryside. Now, the German delegation believes that they're deliberately taken on this roundabout journey to show them the devastation that France has suffered under German occupation.
When the cars reached Amblières, the Germans were then transferred to a train. And with the blinds pulled down to ensure secrecy, they proceeded to its final destination. A gun siding in the forest of Compiègne. Here they would come face to face with Allied Supreme Commander Marshal Ferdinand Foch.
When the German delegation first met Foch in his railway car, Foch was extremely cold to them. The first words out of his mouth were, "What do you want from me?" The Germans said, "We're here to negotiate an armistice." And Foch said, "There will be no negotiation. If you're here, you're here to receive terms from me."
The very sensible suggestion by Matthias Erzberger, the head of the German delegation, was, "We're meeting here on November 8th. We don't know when we're going to conclude. Let's stop the fighting in the meantime." Marshal Foch said no.
The French had sustained over 6 million casualties in the war. Marshal Foch himself had lost his son and his son-in-law on the very same day. He was in no mood for compromise. The Germans returned to their train in the knowledge that Foch had given them just 72 hours to agree to his terms. But despite the expectations of a ceasefire, the fighting would continue.
A soldier firing a machine gun.
Pockets of German soldiers continued to offer stiff resistance to Canadian troops who'd fought their way through northern France and into Belgium. On the 9th of November, the Canadians launched an attack on Mons, a town that the Allies had been driven from at the very start of the war.
The Canadian Corps was probably one of the most respected formations on the Western Front in terms of British formations or Allied formations. It had a reputation by the fall of 1918 of always getting the job done, and they tended to be thrown into the line at the places where the shock troops were needed.
Leading the Canadian Corps was General Sir Arthur Currie, one of Field Marshal Haig's most successful generals.
Mark Humphreys, Western Ontario University.
They're met with machine gun fire, they're met with artillery fire, they're met with snipers. There are Germans resisting in the city. There are Canadians who are wounded and killed on the 10th and in the early hours of the 11th.
Early that morning, Currie was to receive the news that he was waiting for. His Canadian infantry brigade had captured Mons during the night of the 10th and 11th of November.
A railway track winds through a dark forest.
As fighting over Mons concluded, at Compiègne, the negotiations were reaching their climax. The Germans' chief negotiator, Matthias Erzberger, was under increasing pressure to sign.
Erzberger has to telegraph the terms back into Germany, and he receives a reply from the high command in Spa, which says that they are to accept any terms because the situation is so grave. These messages are sent back in the clear. They're uncoded, so the Allies read the messages as they're coming into the German delegation, and they realize the German delegation has no choice but to accept any demands that they put forward.
Archive film of troops charging across a battlefield. Thunderous explosions cause dense clouds of smoke.
Despite the almost inevitable capitulation of the Germans, some of the American generals were determined to continue fighting that day with the same ferocity that had marked the previous 4 years of the war. One of those generals was Charles Summerall.
General Summerall sent his men beginning around midnight of the 11th, to cross the Meuse River. The Meuse on this day It was cold, it was icy, and in the middle of the night, his troops are cobbling together these rickety pontoon bridges, and they're sent across to the other side where the Germans are posted with their machine guns, their artillery, their sharpshooters, and these men crossing the Meuse on the last day of the war are picked off like ducks in a shooting gallery.
Paul Reed, military historian.
We're in the American sector overlooking the Meuse River, which was crossed on the morning of the 11th of November 1918 by the United States Marine Corps, in conditions very similar to that last morning of the war. The Marines scrambled their way down through the trees here, coming out into the open ground that led down to the riverbank itself, and they reached the bridges that the engineers had made for them, and the conditions themselves in crossing the river were appalling, with machine gun, shell fire dropping all around them. And one veteran recorded the differing noise of the machine gun bullets as they first struck the water, then the wooden planking, and then the thud, thud, thud noise as they hit the bodies of his comrades who began to drop around him.
American troops had suffered over 1,100 casualties crossing the Meuse River that morning.
Trees with bare branches stretch up towards a darkened, overcast sky.
Meanwhile, back in the Compiègne forest, the negotiations had reached their climax. The armistice terms dictated by the Allies were severe. Foch told Erzberger that Germany must evacuate Belgium and France, including Alsace-Lorraine. They were to hand over prisoners of war and a huge quantity of their munitions, from battleships to U-boats, from artillery to machine guns. While all the time, the crippling Allied blockade of Germany would continue.
A painting depicts the armistice meeting.
After 3 days of negotiations, Marshal Foch had conceded virtually nothing. The Germans decided the time for talking was over. And at 5:10 on the morning of November the 11th, 1918, the two sides signed.
No photographs of the signing exist, just this one image of the British and French military delegation standing outside Foch's carriage at Compiègne. Immediately, signals were sent to troops in the field that the armistice would come into force, but not until 11 a.m. that morning.
Germany surrenders.
Jubilant newspapers around the world splashed the news that the armistice had at last been signed and the war was now effectively over.
This meant in Paris that work crews were sent out to light the lamps that had been out since the war's beginning in the City of Light. In England, you have Big Ben tolling for the first time in 4 years. And in America, you have people pouring into the streets upon this news, banging pots and pans. You have firehouse sirens shrieking. You have factory whistles blowing. There's only one catch, and that is this war is not over. It's going to run another 6 hours.
Some generals were prepared to let their men stand easy, bide their time for the remaining 6 hours.
They were not going to send men to die in the last hours of the war to gain territory that these men could walk into peacefully after 11 o'clock.
But it had been no great secret that the American commander, General John Pershing, had been unhappy about the armistice.
You might think that the fact that this war's ending would mean the lives of his men would be saved would be satisfying to him. He took a longer view. Pershing wanted to see the Germans driven back to Berlin and to end the war on their knees, not on their feet, in an unconditional surrender. And he said at the time, rather prophetically, that they won't believe now that they were beaten if we do a ceasefire. And we'll just have to do this all over again.
Troops surge across the battlefield.
Some of Pershing's generals were still prepared to send men into action, knowing that the armistice had already been signed.
You had generals who saw a fast, fading opportunity, even these last 6 hours, for victory, for glory, for promotion. And they sent their men out of the trenches with an hour to go, with a half hour to go, in some cases, 15 minutes to go.
One of the more contentious decisions made that morning happened here on the River Meuse at the French town of Stenay, which was held by German troops.
General Wright with the 89th American Division had heard that there were bathing facilities available in that town. And he concluded, well, my troops are tired, they're exhausted, they're dirty, we'll take Stenay, and then they can refresh themselves. Well, that lunatic decision cost something like 300 casualties, many of them battle deaths, for an inconceivable reason.
Present day at the town center church.
Stenay would be the last town taken by the American troops in the First World War. This photograph shows American soldiers, the survivors of that attack, in the town center a few minutes before the 11 o'clock ceasefire. But Stenay wasn't an isolated incident. Soldiers on all sides would continue to go into action right up till the last minute.
Sunlight falls between trees in a cemetery as Michael passes through a circle of headstones.
As the hours and minutes ticked away towards the armistice, the ceasefire at 11 o'clock, who were the last soldiers to die in World War I?
A list of fallen soldiers.
The Commonwealth War Graves Commission gives a name to the soldier believed to be the last British battle casualty of the First World War. Killed on patrol on the outskirts of Mons, his name was George Edwin Ellison.
So we know very, very little about the life of Private George Edwin Ellison. What we can tell you is that he was in the 5th Royal Irish Lancers, that he's buried in St. Symphorin Cemetery, and we can give you the plot, row and grave number.
As a person, George Ellison has remained almost totally forgotten since the day he died. So we've tried to build up a picture of his life. We know that George Ellison was born in 1878 and at some stage joined the army as a regular soldier. By the time he was married in 1912, he'd left the army and become a coal miner. On the outbreak of war in August 1914, he is recalled to the army and joins the 5th Lancers at the age of 36.
What we do know about George Ellison's war comes largely from this thing called the National Roll of the Great Wall, a compilation of all those involved in the Great War, made up from interviews with their families afterwards. And this is the Leeds volume, because it was from Leeds. And here we see him listed, Ellison G.E. Private, 5th Royal Irish Lancers. It tells us that after serving the outbreak of war, he was a serving soldier when war began. He went to France, fought in the retreat from Mons. He also played a prominent part in engagements at Ypres, Armentières, La Bassée, Lens, Luz and Combray, but was, and here they just use this very sort of hard but bland understatement, was unhappily killed only an hour and a half before the armistice came into force. And a quote rounds it off, the path of duty was the way to glory. The thing that strikes me about Ellison's career is how it spans the war and how his war began really in Mons and ended 4 years later in Mons, the very, very last day of the conflict.
A silver pocket watch shows the time is exactly 9:30.
Amongst the Commonwealth War Graves records, there is the mention of a son, James Cornelius Ellison. James was just 5 days short of his 5th birthday when his father was killed.
Two women follow Michael.
Just along up here, all the graves were exactly...
James Cornelius never visited his father's grave.
But you don't know much about him.
No. Well,
James's two daughters, Catherine and Marie, have come to Mons for the first time
to see where their grandfather is buried.
There's his grave. Your grandfather's grave.
Probably the first relatives to visit.
The headstone is inscribed, Private G.E. Ellison, 5th Lancers. Catherine and Marie lay flowers and a card, then stand, heads bowed.
That's quite something, isn't it?
It is. Mm.
It's very emotional.
Yeah.
Very proud.
An hour and a half before.
That must have been terrible for my grandma.
To hear about it at the very end of the war. You hear peace has broken out and then a little bit later you get the message, I suppose.
I suppose she was looking forward to him coming home.
Yeah, yeah. We found a picture of him from a paper.
I can't believe that. Mm. We haven't got any photographs.
No.
There you are. You can have that.
Thank you.
It's got any...
just a reproduction.
Looks, like me, Dad.
Did your father know much about his father and how he died? Did he talk about it much to you?
No.
No, because I don't think they knew much about it, to be quite honest with you.
Mm. My grandma mentioned him to me. Usually remembering Sunday, she used to get upset.
Did she talk about him at all? What kind of person he was?
He was a gentleman. And we seemed to think he was fair because she said I looked like him.
Yeah.
Whether or not
it's true.
Just marvellous seeing his grave and an actual photograph. Yeah. We've never had a photograph of him.
A grainy photograph of a man's unsmiling face.
40-year-old Private Ellison may have been the last British soldier to be killed in action, but he wasn't the last combat death of the war.
Soldiers stand around, chatting cheerfully.
As the final minutes ticked away until the 11 o'clock deadline, still more soldiers were to die.
Christina Holstein, writer and historian.
The last Frenchman to be killed in the First World War officially died at 10 minutes to the armistice, that's 10 to 11. He was a man named Augustin Trébuchon, and he was in the 415th Infantry Regiment at a place called Vrin-Meuse, which is up on the River Meuse near Sedan. And he was a runner. That meant he carried messages from place to place, and he was taking a message to say that the armistice was going to come into force at 11 o'clock, and at 11:30 there would be hot soup available in the dugouts by the canal. And he was killed carrying the message.
40-year-old Trébuchon from Lozère in southern France was one of 75 French soldiers killed in action on that day.
In the churchyard where he's buried, his death is actually dated 10th of November. All the men who were killed on the 11th had their deaths backdated to the 10th, possibly to avoid any question about whether a pension should be paid or not, possibly that the government didn't want families to know that they were still sending men into battle right up to the very end of the war, and so a decision was taken to change the date. But all these men have a date of 10th of November.
A white cross bears the name Augustin Trébuchon.
But as the clock moved ever closer to 11, there were even further battle deaths to record. Canadian soldier George Lawrence Price was to lose his life in the closing minutes of the war beside this modern bridge, which is named after him, yet again on the outskirts of Mons.
So the fighting was really going on, quite organised fighting, right up till the ceasefire at 11 then?
It was. And here, on the outskirts of Mons, the Canadians are moving up the ground here in an urban environment. There's no trenches here.
But they knew that the armistice was going to come into effect there. Officers ordered them to keep on fighting right up to the last minute.
Right up to the last minute, find out where the Germans are. There was a machine gun here that had been firing across onto Price's battalion. When they got here, the machine gun had gone. The Germans, whoever were manning it, had bolted. Him and his mates were talking to some of the Belgian civilians. They were thanking them for liberating Mons after 4 years of occupation when a single shot rang out. Price fell. The Belgian civilians who he and his mates had been chatting to a few minutes before assisted in carrying him into the building. And one young lady ran across the street to assist. Maybe she had some medical skill or something. And she got there to assist, but it was too late. The minutes ticked away. Price succumbed to his wound and died 2 minutes before the armistice. The last Commonwealth casualty of World War I.
50 years later, George Price's comrades returned to Mons and erected a plaque in his memory, close to where he was killed.
An engraver uses a tool to smooth the surface of the headstone.
George Price is buried in St. Symphorien Cemetery, just yards from where the British soldier George Ellison is also buried. But even at 2 minutes to 11, George Price's death wasn't the last before the armistice came into effect.
Black and white film showing thunderous cannon and tank fire explosions. On a pocket watch, it's 1 minute to 11.
Near the village of Chaumont-sur-Dame, here in the Argonne, American troops launched one final attack.
We're above Chaumont. We're on the hillside above that the Germans call the Wettinhöhe, the Wettin Hill, and we're looking down over a wide valley towards a line of hills on the other side, which is where the American troops were on the morning of the 11th of November. And one of the battalions had been given the order to attack east. The order came in at 9:30 in the morning, and they didn't know at that time when the armistice was going to take effect.
Among the troops was Private Henry Gunter, an American, ironically of German origin.
Just with minutes to go, Gunther and other doughboys are advancing on a German machine gun position. And the Germans are horrified by this. They know that this war has minutes to run, and they're waving these doughboys back. Gunther keeps advancing. He's killed. He's shot through the head, dies instantly. He becomes the last formal American death recorded in World War I, and he died at 10:59.
Henry Gunter's divisional history records that almost as he fell, the firing died away and an appalling silence prevailed. The fighting was over. The roar of the guns had ceased as if by magic.
In a forest.
At 11 o'clock, a German machine gunner opposite the South African Brigade north of Mons, having fired off his last round of ammunition, stood up, took off his helmet, bowed and walked off to the rear. After 1,568 days, the Great War, as they called it then, was finally over.
A series of dramatic newspaper headlines proclaiming the end of the war, interspersed with archive film of jubilant crowds running through the streets. Soldiers are smiling and waving their hats in the air.
As the troops celebrated, artillery was muzzled for the last time. Soldiers symbolically buried the last German dud shell.
Grainy footage of a soldier placing a shell in a small makeshift grave.
But even as American and German troops fraternise, there were still tragedies to come. Very probably the last German casualty of the war was killed after the ceasefire, when an officer, Lieutenant Thoma, approached American troops who were unaware that the armistice now had come into force.
Thoma wanted to inform the Americans that his troops will be vacating housing that they've been in through the last months of the war, and this will be available to the American troops now. Unfortunately, he's walking on a group that didn't get the word. This happens invariably in war. There's always somebody who doesn't get the word, and he was shot afterwards, and very likely and maybe symbolically should be viewed as the last German casualty.
A cross bears the inscription, Ein unbekannter deutscher Soldat.
Back in Britain, Queen Mary reflected on the armistice, describing it as the greatest day in the world's history. While the bells rang out in Shrewsbury, the parents of Wilfred Owen received the telegram informing them of their son's death 7 days earlier.
A faded photograph of Wilfred Owen in uniform, film of a soldier being carried away in a stretcher.
But for one group of soldiers, those wounded on the final day of the war, there would be weeks, months, perhaps a lifetime of suffering to follow. Those who survived long enough to make it back to Britain often ended up here in Queen Mary's Hospital in Sidcup, Kent, where some of the most horrific facial injuries were treated.
Dr. Andrew Bamjee takes a box of files from a shelf on the wall.
What sort of injuries were you seeing coming into Queen Mary's at the very end of the war, at the armistice time?
I've got a set of notes here of a chap who was admitted here just before the armistice, in fact, and his name is Thomas of the First Cheshires, and you can see that the whole of the side of the face has been literally just taken off.
Ripped out.
Yes.
And yet he was still alive.
He was still alive.
And
conscious.
I wouldn't have thought that was possible. But
well, as long as it doesn't take off a major artery, then he's not going to bleed to death.
So when were these pictures taken? How soon after the injury?
This is taken about 2 weeks after the injury, and this is actually dated the 6th of November.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we know he would have been here at the time of the armistice itself. And as you go through looking at the reconstructions, and just watch the dates, we're now into 1921, and a whole series of tubes and flaps are being raised. And then when we get to August 1922, we've recreated the upper lip.
Yes, yes.
And then you bring down a last flap to recreate the nose.
Yeah.
And at the very end, this is what you end up with.
Yes.
But our guy is now presentable.
Put his face back, really.
Yes.
Black and white film of wounded soldiers being treated on the battlefield.
What do you feel about the way the wounded and that side of the war is seen?
It's neglected. Perhaps one of the things that really bothers me about the way that we look at war, and perhaps even the First World War in particular, is we only focus on the glorious dead. And in a sense, we're not allowed to see the people who have been disfigured in the way that Private Thomas was disfigured. And if we don't look at that sort of thing, how can we possibly understand what war was really all about?
In a file, the shocking photographs of Private Thomas show the hideous injury which has left much of his lower face torn away.
No one will ever know for certain how many soldiers died on that final morning of the First World War. But one nation in particular suffered more battle deaths than the others. 25 miles north of Verdun in France is the American Meuse-Argonne Military Cemetery. With over 14,000 graves of US soldiers killed in the closing weeks of World War I, this is the biggest American war cemetery in Europe. Despite its vast size, this only represents one-third of those who were originally buried here. Two-thirds of American servicemen's families chose to bring the bodies of their loved ones home, including the family of Henry Gunter, the last U.S. soldier to die in the First World War.
Now, this is the grave of Curtis Southern, the same regiment as Henry Gunter, who also died on the last day of the war. And it's one of over 100 crosses in this cemetery which bear the date November 11th, 1918. But when you consider how many of the Americans originally buried here were repatriated home, the number of crosses bearing this date should have been considerably greater.
A battlefield is littered with dead bodies.
Official US figures reveal that America suffered nearly 3,000 casualties on the final day of the war. They were casualty figures which the American public back home found unacceptable and resulted in a congressional hearing on the actions of the American commanders that day.
The initial report found that there had been dereliction of duty by officers who sent men to die for yardage that they could have walked into peacefully the following day. In the end, though, the report was suppressed essentially because it was felt that the Americans had been victorious, that had been led by these generals, and it would be a stain on their name and on their honor to publish these results.
General John Pershing, the bullish leader of the American forces, was unrepentant about the huge number of casualties that morning, giving a robust defense to the Congressional Investigating Committee.
General Pershing was not at all apologetic. He felt that the war had to be continued to the very last minute because, in his judgment, Germany had to be proven to have been defeated. And it had been to him, up to him, they would not have stopped fighting in a ceasefire at all. He would have pushed on all the way to Berlin and demanded an unconditional surrender.
A long parade marches towards palace gates.
It would be 7 months later, in June 1919, at the Treaty of Versailles, when the First World War would officially come to a close.
A palace hall is filled with delegates.
But for one German soldier, the signing of the armistice at the railway carriage at Compiègne was an act of national betrayal.
Adolf Hitler had been a corporal in the German army in World War I. And when he learns of the armistice, he bursts out into tears. He's shattered that his country has lost the war. And he claims in Mein Kampf that at this point he said, I will devote my life to erasing that shame.
In June 1940, following the fall of France at the start of the Second World War, Hitler symbolically returned to that same railway carriage in the same location, where, in a ceremony full of Nazi pomp and theater, he accepted the French surrender. The Forest of Compiègne played a pivotal role in two world wars. The armistice of the 11th of November 1918 may have brought an end to the first round of slaughter. But even so, some estimates put the figure of those soldiers killed, wounded or missing on the last day of World War I in excess of 10,000 people.
The shocking numbers of those killed in the final hours of World War I doesn't even include those who would have died of their wounds days, weeks, months later. In the end, does a death on the last day of the war, is it any worse than a death on any other day of the war? Like that of my great uncle, Harry Palin, who was killed in action on the Somme in September 1916. When all's said and done, November the 11th, 1918 was like any other day of that brutal war, a day of slaughter, bloodshed, and terrible waste of life.